Here's Andy Udman.
Pam, why do we have to take all these mineral supplements, vitamin and mineral supplements? It's a huge business. Shouldn't we be getting that from the food we eat?
Well, many of our key minerals should be coming from animal foods, yes. And because our soils are so depleted of minerals, that's one reason why, it's only one reason why we're not getting enough minerals. There are many other reasons why, but one of the reasons is because of industrial agriculture depleting our soils of some very key minerals, and because the animals are not having access to the grass that should be growing in this soil. Instead, of course, these animals are being raised in factory farms and being fed foods that are totally foreign to them.
Live from 743 Wellington Road South in South London, I want to talk to you about nutrition this morning. Here's the analogy. You don't put gas in your car that's half water. The sad thing is, we're doing it to our bodies. I hope Deb Matthews, our health minister, is listening this morning, because she is tearing her hair out for 17 different reasons, but one of them has to be what's happening to our health care budgets. And what's happening to our health? As Pam Colleen likes to say, we're sicker, we're fatter, and more depressed than ever. Why is that? And all we keep hearing about is pills and medicine and drugs and hospitals when we're missing the obvious. We're missing the basics, and that is what we're putting in our mouths. Good morning, Pam. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Andy. I'm fantastic. How are you?
We're good. You're looking great this morning. You were out playing tennis
yesterday.
In the heat yesterday.
Yeah, I played yesterday.
I don't know what veggies you're eating to give you that kind of stamina.
No. It's lots of butter. Don't forget that.
Yeah. Bacon and butter. Yes. No, you wouldn't. You're a recovering vegetarian. It wouldn't be broccoli that you were. Let's talk about what we put in our mouths. What's wrong with what we're putting in our mouths?
Well, essentially, let's talk about what we're not getting in terms of the right information. We're not getting the right information so that we can make the proper food choices. And second to that, in the background, of course, the food that we're getting isn't properly produced. So we're getting highly processed foods. And if we are getting animal foods, of course, they come from factory farm settings, which are very unhygienic. And these foods are not giving us the proper nutrients that our bodies need to run on.
I hear doctors, my own chiropractor, who also sells vitamins and minerals, but she says, Andy, the foods we eat today are hollow. What does that mean?
Well, it just means that they're not as nutrient dense as they could be or should be. Our ancestors knew how to produce food properly, and therefore we would have had more nutrition in our food from the get-go. But today, we're simply not getting the proper nutrition in the food to begin with.
Our boys have all worked in corn, detasseling corn in Toronto, in the Dresden area. And one of the things that struck me in the Dresden area is they grow tomatoes. And the way you grow tomatoes today is at some point you want them all to be ripe at the same time. So what you do is you spray this chemical on them, and amazingly, in a day or two, they're all red and ready to pick.
Mm.
So we're rushing nature, and I'm thinking, that can't be good.
Yep, changing the nature of nature. No, it's not good. I mean, and tomatoes aren't the tomatoes of yesteryear.
No,
right?
When I was a kid, it seemed tomatoes had taste.
Today, they're like rubber, you know, like strawberries, too, like rubber. They're just not the same, and unfortunately, our kids will not know the difference, because they'll think that these rubber tomatoes are high quality, when we know, historically, they were juicier than they are today.
As you know, I have a lot of friends on the farm, and I'm going to ask them to be patient this morning, and let's all make this a learning experience. We have a very special guest.
That's right. This morning we have Dr. Peter Ballerstadt on the line, and he is an expert in grass feeding, and he has really converted his life over to more education on nutrition based on his doctorate in agriculture. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Peter, welcome to London, Ontario.
Thank you. Belated Happy Canada Day.
Well, thank you, and belated Independence Day. Did you have a good time on July 4th?
Oh, I mowed the grass.
that's appropriate.
Peter, I want to talk to you about, if we could start with where Pam and I were just touching on, the food that we're eating. What's wrong with the food that we're eating? We're trying to link this to our exploding health care budget in Ontario, which we're having across Canada, and we've been watching what you guys are doing south of the border. You have the same issues there. And we keep hearing about drugs, and it's all about hospitals and drugs and surgery, and no, it's about nutrition. What is wrong with what we're putting in our mouths, Peter?
I think the fundamental issue is that we, for the last several decades, have been told that the proper diet for human beings must be one that's primarily carbohydrate. And that, in the face of evidence from the very beginning that said that that wasn't true, and then since that, you can see the results in terms of burgeoning rates of obesity and diabetes and all the other chronic illnesses.
Give us a list of the foods under carbohydrates which we think are straight from God and guarantee good health when they do just the opposite.
Well, you could start with the misnamed healthy whole grains. You could add to that starchy vegetables, which would include potatoes, white potatoes. You could add to that material that is called vegetable, although it isn't, such as sweet corn. And add to that, it probably wouldn't be thought of as necessarily healthy, although at one time it was, sugar, refined sugar, and sweeteners, caloric sweeteners in all their very many different forms. White flour, those sorts of things, grain products, even the non, that would include whole grain as well as refined.
Now, Peter,
all of those have been shown to be problematic to people who, to a significant portion of the population.
Now, Peter, you had your own personal epiphany over nutrition. Can you share your story with us?
Sure. In Christmas 2007, I set up the camera on the tripod, you know, hit the timer, run back to get in the picture. And when I saw the picture, you know, I said, oh, my goodness. Several of my friends had been diagnosed with prediabetes. And the latest statistics are that in 8 years or so, half of all adult Americans in the United States will either be diabetic or prediabetic. And I was manifesting several warning signs that I was a candidate for that as well. By that point, my wife had been on a restricted carbohydrate journey of her own for about, oh, I guess it would be 5-6 years. But she was clever enough to know that talking to me about it before I was ready to listen to her talk to me about it probably wouldn't be beneficial.
Peter, let me just jump in. You have just said something that, you know, quite often on this show, I know that there are some people who tune out when we discuss health because they're saying, we're okay. You know, we have a greater choice of food today than ever before. And here you are saying that, if I understood this correctly, that in the very next few years, one half of all Americans living in the richest country in the world will either be diabetic or pre-diabetic. That is scandalous. What are we doing wrong?
I think it gets back to the basic that we're trying to behave as if we are carbohydrate burners as opposed to fat burners.
But our, you know, Health Canada, our food guide, basically emphasizes carbohydrates in our diet.
I'm very sorry that we did that to you.
On behalf
of the United States, let me apologize.
I think there are some of our listeners who practically drove off the road a couple of moments ago because you just went down the list of their favorite foods.
I truly do. I've now been on this path for several years, and there are things that one misses when you take this diet, but when you understand the underlying science and you admit the nature of your problem, then you're left making the decision of, am I going to go down the road that leads to ultimately dialysis and amputation, or am I going to, and other unfortunate outcomes, or am I going to take it in my own hands and apply the science? And, you know, I understand that it's very hard to get off cigarettes. I did that 21 years ago. But if you understand that while not everyone who smokes gets lung cancer, but almost, you know, everyone who gets lung cancer smokes, then if you don't want to get lung cancer, you stop smoking.
Doctor, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you about, I just saw this item on TV a couple of nights ago. They did a feature on restaurants, and One of the very popular restaurants here is Angelo's, and one of the reasons it's so popular is fresh bread. And you've got this on your evil list. And then you had the audacity to add another item, which I'm still in shock over, sweet corn. What could possibly be wrong with nine-grain bread and sweet corn with a little salt and a little butter? We'll be back with Pam and Dr. Peter in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. The comments I've heard in the last few moments remind me of horses when you put blinders on them so they can just see straight ahead and not get distracted by the reality all around them. For horses, it works. For we as a society, it's absolute disaster. We are not seeing the full picture when it comes to our health care situation, our health as a society. In just the last few minutes, Dr. Peter Balderstadt has been telling us that one half of Americans in the next few years will be either diabetic or pre-diabetic. And one of the reasons is what we eat. And the list, oh my goodness, is going to drive you crazy. Your favorites, mashed potatoes, whole grains, your favorite breads, sweet corn, sugar. Heard of someone at Tim Hortons recently who in one big coffee ordered 5 creams and 10 sugars. Dr. Peter, we're killing ourselves. Nothing short of it.
That's one bite at a time. And some of us are more susceptible than others. That's why we don't see this as a uniform thing. That's why we're not saying all adult Americans will be pre-diabetic or diabetic. But a substantial number will be. And the information goes on that for years we've understood, we should have understood, that in fact a low-fat diet will increase your risk of heart disease.
And when you say low-fat, let's be very clear, you're talking about a diet low in animal fat.
Absolutely, but the current, every 5 years they trundle out another set of guidelines for us in the United States, and I'm ashamed to say that probably, you know, pollutes across the border into your country. That currently, the current guidelines say that less than 30% of our calories ought to be coming from fat. More than 60% ought to be coming from carbohydrate. And 10% of the calories, or actually I think it's more like 7, should be coming from saturated fat, which would be primarily from animal sources, but not exclusively. And if you have a diet that's low in fat, you by definition have a diet that's high in carbohydrates.
Peter, let's spend a moment just on what you just said, because if there's anything that I get backlash to on the things that Pam says, is it drives people crazy when she, and now you, suggest that the phrase low fat, which has become part of our DNA, there's God, there's country, there's the military, there's Wayne Gretzky, and then there's low fat. And that's what we're all about.
Doesn't Sidney Crosby come in there?
And Sidney Crosby after the big contract. And you're now saying that low fat has horns and is evil.
Well, I don't know that low fat would be evil, but in terms of the science that would support the idea that low fat is heart healthy, we have clear evidence that a low fat, that is high carbohydrate diet, will do 3 things very reliably. It will raise your triglycerides. It will reduce your HDL cholesterol, your high-density lipoprotein cholesterol, and it will shift the particle size of your LDL particles from large, fluffy, relatively benign to small, dense, more disease-producing forms. So in 3 significant ways, a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet will increase your risk of coronary heart disease.
But this is a diet that doctors are still recommending today, even though the science shows otherwise.
I understand.
So, what's wrong with our doctors?
I shudder to make blanket statements about any group of people. We find numerous physicians who understand and espouse the kinds of ideas that I'm just passing along. I haven't done the research on this. I've just read and have my own experience, and I can put, you know, lines between dots and come up with where I am now. So I'm just trying to pass this information along. Physicians, when they are trained in our universities, typically don't get great emphasis on nutrition in their course of study. I think Gary Taubes once said that, you know, depending on the nutritionist teaching the course, that may or may not be a good idea. But it's not the emphasized subject matter for them. So as someone who got a minor in ruminant nutrition when I received my doctorate, I've probably had a great deal more training in nutrition than the average physician.
And yet,
then once they're out in practice, of course, where is their ongoing education going to come from?
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, what you're saying is our doctors, many of them, we can't include all of them, are simply bypassing, because of their ignorance, the most effective tool there is when it comes to restoring our health, and that is good nutrition, about which they know virtually nothing.
Well, indeed, and one could take it another step and say, yes, good nutrition, but then you have to make sure that we all understand what good nutrition means, because it's a buzzword. And so somebody could hear good nutrition and think that that means a low-fat diet, because we've had all of these messages delivered to us that say the heart-healthy diet is low-fat and avoid cancer by limiting red meat and plant-based diets and all those kinds of ideas that have been delivered, that each one of which, when you chase it down, has no scientific basis.
But let's talk about science versus common sense. Isn't a lot of what you're saying simply common sense?
It certainly was to our ancestors. There's absolutely no question. We have now good historical information looking at what happened to populations when some of these refined forms of carbohydrate were introduced into their traditional diets, and the degrading of their health, the appearance of what we now call Western diseases. So we have, for example, the idea that our grandparents would have had that said that working up an appetite was a common phrase that you could expect someone to say, and now it's one of the fundamental tenets of how to lose weight, is to go out and burn up more calories and exercise, as if that wouldn't make you hungry in doing it.
Mm-hmm. Peter, we have to take a short break, but there are some of our audience who are going, I can't handle this guy taking a big black marker and going right down my list of favorite foods. So we need to keep reminding ourselves of why we're having this discussion. Before we go to the short break for a news update, can you again give us that one startling figure about the state of people's health in North America?
Figures that have been released estimate that by 2020, half of all adult Americans will either be diabetic or pre-diabetic. And what we need to understand about that is that diabetes is part of what we call metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is a group of diseases that are now understood to be related. So obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, Alzheimer's disease, cancer, all of these are related to each other. So as we increase the rate of diabetes and prediabetes, we can expect to see an increasing rate of all these other diseases as well.
Dr. Peter Balderstadt back with us, Pam Colleen and Andy Udman, in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Figures that have been released estimate that by 2020, half of all adult Americans will either be diabetic or pre-diabetic.
That is the one takeaway from that first half hour that just rocked my boat. That very soon, half of all North Americans will be diabetic or pre-diabetic. We have a crisis, folks, and it's not just our finances and how we're going to pay for all our health care issues. We have a crisis, of course, in a host of areas. Diabetes is just one of them. We are, if you have just joined us in conversation with Pam Colleen and with Dr. Peter Ballerstadt. Is that how you pronounce it, Peter?
That's good.
I snuck in a couple of extra letters there to give it a little pizzazz, but it's Ballerstadt. And while we're at it, for people, and they often do this during the show, is check out the websites of our guests. Do you have a website?
I have a blog site. If you Google grass-based health, you will find me listed.
Okay, let's talk about grass-based health. What is grass-based health?
It's the idea, again, we've alluded to it already, that our diet ought to be based on animal products. And the reality is that today, even today, with our modern sort of production systems, if you look in America, you look at the cattle herd in America, over 80% of the feed that's used to feed the beef and dairy cows and calves and bulls in the United States, over 80% of that's already forage. So even today, even with what we've got, it's grass-based.
Not everybody would be familiar with the term forage.
Forage, in general sense, are those crops that are, or those plants that are produced to be eaten by livestock, either as pasture or as conserved as hay or silage.
Now, what is the difference, though, between what animals should be eating in nature versus what they're getting in the factory farms?
Well, if we just stick with cattle or any other ruminant animal, ruminant animals clearly were, if I can use the word, designed to eat grass or other forage material. They were designed to ingest low-fat, low-starch, high-fiber diets. What's happening today is to support higher levels of production, they've been fed diets that have increasing amounts of starch or grain component in the diet in many cases.
Now, but also with regards to the grass feeding of animals, what are the benefits, not just in terms of the health of the animal, but also included in that is the better nutrition as well?
Indeed, they go hand in hand. There's work that the company that I work for in conjunction with the University of Wisconsin has done that shows that by even taking some corn silage and some alfalfa silage out of sort of typical high production dairy ration and replacing it with an Italian ryegrass silage, you had an increase in the milk fat test indicating a shift in the rumen pH and a healthier condition, which was also evidenced by, in that test it was not evidenced by a reduction in lameness, but what we know is that this subacute rumen acidosis, one of its symptoms is lameness. And so by looking at the increase in butterfat, we know that the pH is higher in the rumen. We're avoiding that subacute rumen acidosis, which means that we're also likely to see a reduction in lameness in cattle. So there's an impact on production, and there's an impact on animal health, which will manifest itself as a reduced need to cull animals, which may, in the end, yield greater productivity.
Peter,
and that's in a confinement operation.
Peter, whenever our guests use $50 words, we, on the one hand, really admire them. On the other hand, we want to bring it back to our audience. What is the significance to our audience of what you just said?
Well, if you're a dairyman, what the significance is that we need to be utilizing more high-quality grass in the diet of your animal, regardless of whether you're a pasture base or a confinement operation.
We have, right on the edge of London, if I stood up on the roof of the radio station, I could almost see it, just on the southeast edge of London on the 401, one of the biggest dairy farms in all of Canada. It is huge. I'm trying to remember the number of dairy cattle. Is that, should we feel good about that and about the products that come from that dairy farm, the classic factory farm, which Pam refers to?
Yeah, the term factory farm is pejorative in its sense. So clearly, factory farm is not something we would feel good about. We have to look at what's actually happening on that operation. Let's take a step back and say, In our country, we have a crisis where our dairymen are saying that if they don't get $20 U.S. per 100 pounds of milk, they're not going to be able to make a profit. And I have been on dairies that are pasture-based where, and they're running 1,200 cows on pasture. So some people consider a factory farm, you know, a large number of animals. Well, there's 1,200. That's pretty big. And their total cost of production, all cost of production, they figure at somewhere around $14 a hundredweight. Now, could they make money at 20? Yes, absolutely. So we have this crisis with our model of agriculture in the United States, and you have some people who are saying that there's one way to address that, and then you have other people who are saying, you know, maybe, just maybe, we need to be looking at what it costs to produce the product. And when you start doing that, then you start looking at all kinds of things. And I could point to another example of a organic pasture-based Jersey dairyman just north of where I live in western Oregon, who 20 years ago, he was organic, he was pasturing, but he was feeding 20 pounds of grain per head per day, and he was producing almost 19,000 pounds of milk, which is a good average for Jerseys. Today, he's feeding about 2 pounds because he says he just can't help himself. And he says that their milk yield per animal has dropped to about 12,000 pounds per head per year, but he figures that he's doubled his profit.
But let's talk about some of the other benefits to grass feeding. We live in a province here where we had a crisis with E. coli in a city named Walkerton, which has the highest concentration of factory farms in Ontario. And this E. coli contamination happened after a heavy rainfall. And of course, a lot of people don't understand that these manure lagoons are huge threats, not just to the environment, to our health as well. And we know through research from Health Canada, the CFIA, University of Guelph, that when you put animals out on grass, that this will reduce the chances that the animal will shed E. coli. Can you talk about this phenomenon and why our quote-unquote experts don't seem to come forward as often as they should to promote more sustainable agriculture?
Well, we do have a number of people who talk about sustainable agriculture, and when I was at the University, Oregon State University, I had conversations with people who are very active in sustainable agriculture, and what they told me, in direct quote, almost, it's been several years, but basically, animals have no place in sustainable agriculture.
Hmm.
Now, what we have to understand is, just like we said before, you have to tease out what people mean by healthy diet. So much of what we've gotten has been heavily influenced by the vegetarian ethic. And so we have to tease that all out to make sure we're really talking about fact as opposed to belief system-based ideas. So, all that being said, improperly managed lagoons, improperly managed municipal water systems, in other words, where you have the opportunity for surface water to enter into the well system, all those are issues, and you can't necessarily blame it all on one source, right? It was a failure, it was a terrible tragedy, and we need to look at these. There is the thought that forage-based systems or forage feeding reduces E. coli. Unfortunately, that was all based on some preliminary research that has not been panned out as they've looked at it in greater rigor, in larger amounts, in real world.
Peter, we have to take a short break, but Peter, another Peter wants to jump in with a comment. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the diet that the doctor had talked about. Last year, me and my wife went on that diet briefly, and I have to say that it did work wonders for both of us. We had more energy. We just felt that much better. We lost weight without even trying, just by changing what we ate. And I just want to say that if for people who are listening, they should give it a try.
What was that? Give us the 20-second snapshot of the diet you went to.
Well, it was basically the Atkins diet. It was a low-carb, high-fat, high-protein diet. And I have to say, at first, it was hell. When we first went on it, we felt like hell because it was a total shift from the way we were used to eating. But in the end, it benefited both of us greatly. Now, we've got off track, and we were just actually talking about this yesterday, about getting back on it. So after listening to you, we're definitely going to get back on it because I think that is the way to go. My wife's blood sugar came down when she was on it because she's been diabetic, and I just have to say it's the best. You hit it right on the nail.
Peter, Dr. Peter, would you respond and also just share quickly your weight loss story?
Well, congratulations, Peter, for your family's journey, and because you have to do the work, and so I'm glad to hear that.
That's right, and it was very hard.
And thank you for confirmation. Yep. My weight loss is when I started, I was at my heaviest over 220 pounds, which at 5'10 is obese per the BMI scale. And I managed to achieve a 50-pound weight loss, and not surprisingly, I haven't been able to maintain all of that. I'm now within 10 pounds of my lowest weight, and that's over, well, like I say, I started the end of 2007. So what, normalized blood sugar, normalized blood lipids, blood pressure, all systems fine, and feeling very, very happy about it.
What diet?
As he says, basically one would understand it to be Atkins, although what I followed was a diet plan written by Dr. Mary, Dan, and Michael Eads called the Protein Power Diet. There are many forms of carbohydrate restriction. It's not a new or fad idea. It's been with us for over 100 years.
Okay, Peter, we're going to have to let you go. And Dr. Peter, we're going to be back in just a moment to ask you for the takeaways from our conversation today. We're in conversation with Dr. Peter Ballerstadt from Oregon, along with Pam Killeen. We'll be back in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Figures that have been released estimate that by 2020, half of all adult Americans will either be diabetic or pre-diabetic.
Pam, do you think the average person on the street has even a clue of the crisis that we're facing?
I don't think so. I don't think people really understand how serious this situation is, especially when we look at our young people today, our children today, and how sick they are.
And that's why we bring on Pam Killeen. That's why we bring on guests like Peter Ballerstadt. Peter, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I think it's so important that we give our audience the most important takeaways from our conversation. Would you just summarize in the next 2 or 3 minutes what you think is so important for our audience to understand, given the crisis that we're facing with our health in North America, and what the answers you think are?
I'll try. Number one point is that we have been told incorrectly what the nature of a healthy diet is. As a result of that, we now see a situation that was not present when we were first given the information. So it's clear, to me at least, that the guidance we've been given has been a failure. So there are places to go for more information. I would suggest places like Weston A. Price Foundation. You can find them on the web. I would also suggest books like Gary Taubes' books. Probably the first place to start would be Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It. Taubes is spelled T-A-U-B-E-S. And there's a number of other places, blogs, that you can get more information to educate yourself, because unfortunately we have not been well served by the public health interests in our country and, I'm assuming, in Canada.
There's another resource I should mention before we finish here is that I'm going to be featured in a Real Food Summit starting next week, July the 8th, with Sean Croxton from Underground Wellness. And it's from July 8th to July 16th. And there's all sorts of wonderful speakers who are going to be talking about real food. Joel Salatin is speaking. Dr. Kate Shanahan will be speaking. Chris Masterjohn will be speaking. And all you need to do is go to realfoodsummit.com and you're going to see some of these people talking about a lot of the concepts that Peter is mentioning today.
Dr. Peter, just in summation here, if we keep going on the track that we're on, what kind of health crisis are we going to face in 10 years?
Well, we're already facing the crisis, so just make it worse. As the population ages, the pressure from chronic illness gets worse. All of the diseases that are part of metabolic syndrome are extremely costly. They certainly cut down on the quality of life of the people who have to deal with them. And as was mentioned earlier, what we're seeing in our youth is the earlier appearance of diseases that we used to think of as ones that would come in middle age or later in adults. And so we see this happening where we can no longer call it type 2. We used to call it adult onset diabetes, and now we have to call it type 2 because our children are getting it. And as you look down the road, it's interesting to realize that the cutting edge researchers are starting to look at the link between obesity and cancer rather than mutagens and cancer. And we're starting to look at Alzheimer's disease as type 3 diabetes.
Now, to make the changes we need to make in agriculture, this really has to be driven by consumers. Consumers need to get passionate about this subject, and they need resources. We need more farms, for example, in the London area. There are some existing farms that are doing more sustainable agriculture, and for Londoners, they can go to a website, www.londonorganicfarms.com, to find some of these farmers. But to change supply and demand, it really needs to come from the consumer, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The marketplace will respond. And at the same time, I think the farmers themselves need to be educated about what is possible. We've been taught that forages are low-quality feedstuffs. We've received that message from various sources, but it is possible to take, say 14 pounds of dry matter from a perennial ryegrass white clover pasture that can produce a pound of hanging weight on a carcass. You can take 7 pounds of dry matter and make a pound of milk fat from it.
Doctor, we have to leave it there because we are just out of time. I just keep coming back to that absolutely startling fact, which people should take away from our conversation today. And that is what to me has been the most shocking fact that you have given us, and that is the state of our health in North America. Give us 20 seconds, if you would.
Well, we are in the grip of an epidemic of metabolic syndrome. One symptom of that is this observation, prediction that in 8 years, half of all adult Americans are either going to be diabetic or pre-diabetic.
Absolutely shocking, Doctor. And we thank you for joining us. We wish we had more time, and we appreciate your warning us about what lies ahead.
Glad to do it, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
We'd love to have you back on. And everybody, if you want more information, Peter's got tremendous information on his website, Grass-Based Health.
Grass-Based Health. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Pam, you got to promise me one thing. As you're driving home, you got to cover your ears, okay? Or turn the radio, because we're going to talk to McLean's Magazine right after the top of the hour about the 100-mile mess, why the local food movement is bad for economies, the environment, and even your health. I'm going to give you 15 seconds to comment.
Well, I think, the multinational food companies certainly do not like this effort to buy more local sustainable foods, and they're putting a lot of pressure on not just our governments, but on our media, obviously. I haven't read the article, but that's my first reaction to it.
Okay, don't want you driving off the road when you hear us talking to McLean's Magazine about the 100-mile mess. When we come back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.